This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Back in the fall of 2004, a new fantasy novel, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, by a newcomer, Susanna Clarke, hit the bookstores and became an instant classic. And it won the Hugo Award for 2004's Best Novel at the World Science Fiction Convention in 2005. I had the chance to interview Susanna Clarke on September 12, 2005, in the KPFA studios when she went on tour for the paperback edition of Jonathan Strange. The interview was edited down to fill a half-hour KPFA slot, and no edit of the complete interview was ever made until now. Stay tuned after the interview for a look at Susanna Clarke's career over the past two decades. This is your first novel, but I understand you have two earlier unpublished novels?
I have scraps of two earlier unpublished novels. This was the first thing that I ever completed. So the years that I spent writing it, the whole thing that was hanging over my head the whole time was, will I be able to finish? That was the big question.
Which took you 10 years to write?
Yeah. The whole time, apart from the last 2-3 months, I was working. I had a full-time job, so I was writing in the early mornings and at weekends. So that's one reason it took 10 years. The other is I'm quite a slow writer.
This is an alternate version of England in which magic exists. And you have two primary characters, Mr. Norrell, who is trying to bring magic back to England, and Jonathan Strange, a young man who is apparently his apprentice, but actually goes past the master very, very early on. And it involves fairies and people from the other world, if you want to call it that. It's very, very organized, very consistent within itself. When you're working on a novel this large, and it's your first book, how do you maintain that kind of consistency?
I don't have a very good answer to that. When I first was thinking about the book, I could see in my mind a kind of abstract shape that it would have. I knew the kind of emotional pattern it would have. So I knew, for example, where it would be dark emotionally and where it would be light and more humorous. And that, I think I stuck to that pattern quite closely. I also knew where the characters would end up emotionally and where the world would be when the book ended. But as for the style, I think I established that fairly quickly, and it felt quite natural to me, so it was easy to maintain consistency in the style. As for the plot, I can only ever plot 3 or 4 chapters ahead at a time, and I just have to hope that things were going to turn out right.
There's more to it than that, which is that you've created an actual world here, which borders on real history, but really takes off into alternate history, which means everything within that alternate history needs to be consistent within itself. You know, Tolkien spent years working on the world that he created for Lord of the Rings. Did this just come up within the context of writing?
I began with the idea that I was going to insert a chronology of magicians into existing English history. I didn't begin by working out the details of that world. All I knew was that at one end of this chronology of magicians, there would be a powerful magician king who would be a little bit mysterious, but from him all of English magic would flow. And at the other end, in the early 19th century, there would be these two magicians who worked together, but who eventually would quarrel. And the rest grew organically as I was writing. So I think there's a lot in there, a lot of detail, which I haven't quite worked out the full implications. The world has been growing a lot during the 10 years I've been writing it.
Do you keep separate notes on how it's been growing?
I keep notes, but they're kind of scattered about all over the place. So, I'm sure I wrote down somewhere something very interesting about a theory some magicians had about every human having a kind of fairy counterpart. I've looked everywhere on my computer. I cannot find this. Maybe it was just a fleeting idea.
Or maybe it comes out of Philip Pullman. I don't know.
It could be.
Susanna Clark, let's talk a little about the genesis of this book. And it involves the genesis of Susanna Clark. You worked as a cookbook editor for several years?
I was, all the time I was writing this book, I was working for a little bit of Simon & Schuster, which is in Cambridge, England. I think it's a small office they don't even know they've got, and we did mainly cookbooks.
During that time, you joined a writing class that was taught by a novelist and critic named Colin Greenland, right?
Yes. This was very early on in the life of the novel. I had never tried to write a straight fantasy before. I had often had a sort of fantastic feel, atmosphere to things I'd written. But I thought with this book, I ought to join a workshop and learn how science fiction fantasy was done. And this was a week-long course run by Jeff Ryman and Colin Greenland. And they were very, very encouraging. It was kind of a turning point because Colin Greenland is now my partner.
That means that by the time you joined the class, you were already working on Jonathan Strange.
I was, yeah. And I also wrote for that class a short story, which was called The Ladies of Grâce à Dieu, which featured Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. That was the first thing I ever got published in the end. And it also proved to me, most importantly, that I could finish something, because I think it was also the first thing I ever finished.
Let's go back even further. In other interviews, you've talked about the role of reading fantasy in your life. Now, you read Ursula K. Le Guin. You've read, obviously, J.K. Rowling. You also credit, oddly enough, Joss Whedon.
Yes. I can't say that Buffy has had a big influence on Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I didn't get into Buffy until I think about season 4 when it was shown in the UK. But I recognized a lot of things that I love in fantastic literature, fantastic television. I think Joss Whedon is a kind of genius. I mean, he puts together the fantastic and the mundane in a way that I really recognize, and which is something that I tried to do in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, make the fantasy more real by showing the everyday lives of your characters.
Fantasy in England has a somewhat different tradition than in America. In America, outside of Poe and some early fantasists, most of it is genre fiction, discounting recent magic realism. But over in England, it's a little bit different because you have people like C.S. Lewis writing it. You had Tolkien. Later on, I think Alan Garner is British. So it comes out of a different tradition. Did you notice that at all?
I think one of the things which is important is that all of these, Lewis and Tolkien and Garner, are all very much aware of things like Norse myths, which aren't English, but I guess are close enough to us and familiar enough, certainly to Lewis and Tolkien, that they seem part of our literature. And then you've got things like the Arthurian legend. So there is a very long history of fantastic writing in England. And you've also got the fact that if you go back not too far, people actually did believe in fairies and the supernatural. I mean, it's not too long ago that every English field was populated by some fairies or other.
You've said that when asked what is the historical precedent for the world you created, you said basically none. I mean, there's nothing like the magic of your book in real life, right?
That's right. The only research that I did on the magical side was into fairy beliefs, which aren't that well documented in England. But if you look at Scottish and Welsh and Irish literature, you can find more there.
But you did a lot of historical research, particularly on Wellington, Waterloo, Bonaparte, right?
Yeah. I found the military history particularly rewarding, which was kind of strange because I was expecting to find it particularly difficult and boring. But what I discovered was that military history is very vivid. It's very immediate. If you research something like Waterloo, a lot of people wrote memoirs, ordinary soldiers as well as officers, and you can almost trace somebody's entire experience of that particular day, you know, when they made tea, what they said to their comrades. It makes it very vivid.
Jane Austen plays a role here. You always loved reading Jane Austen.
I've been a fan of Jane Austen's for as long as I can remember, and I don't know how many times I've read those six novels.
Because this book is very much a Regency comedy.
Yeah, I originally thought of it as an 18th century book. In my mind, Strange and Norrell were both going to be 18th century characters, but as I started writing about it, they crept forward to the early 19th century, and I started looking at Austen because I wanted the book to feel like an early 19th century book, like you'd picked up a book that just happened to be a fantasy. And so I looked at the way she used language, and I also referred constantly to her for the sort of social history, because there's no better guide to the way people behaved and thought than Jane Austen.
So that makes, in a sense, the voice of the novel pretty clear. You know exactly what you're going to be doing.
Yes. I think it's sort of like three parts Jane Austen to about two parts a lot of other people. And I'd include Dickens and C.S. Lewis, E. Nesbitt, and I think there's a bit of possibly Arthur Conan Doyle in there.
The politics sitting behind Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the politics of that era, do you see any connection whatsoever between politics today and politics of then, or is the difference so great that nothing really would seep in?
This was not something that I had consciously on my mind while I was writing. All of my writing so far has had a historical background, and when I'm thinking about that and when I'm researching it, my main effort is directed towards showing how different the past has been rather than how similar it is to the present. I think often with history books, popular history books nowadays, too much emphasis is placed on, oh, of course, this is almost an exact equivalent to something we have now. I think that the kind of moral issues in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell are more general than political. They're about the uses of power and knowledge. And in that way, you do see some relevance for all times.
But there's no subtext that someone should be looking for.
I think when I write, I am mainly concentrating on character and story, because that's what tends to speak to me first in books that I love. But I think if you are awake enough and if you describe characters accurately, then subtexts will creep in, and your opinions, sometimes even opinions that you didn't know you had till you started writing, they will appear.
Can you give any examples of things you've discovered after publishing or after writing the book?
I think the whole thing about Mr. Norrell and the library and the way he clings to his library and doesn't want anyone else to read the books. Yeah, it wasn't something I had consciously planned, but that there is this strong equation, as I say, in the book between knowledge and power and the uses of knowledge and the way it should be made free for everybody to have a say and not kept under a strict control.
And of course, when Jonathan Strange tries to open up that knowledge to the world, Norrell does a little spell to keep it from happening.
Yeah, he can't be having that.
Let's talk a little, Susanna Clarke, about the genesis of characters in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. As you say, you didn't have an outline, so you kind of just started writing to see where it would go. So these characters develop. I understand one of the characters who becomes very important toward the end of the book, a man named Childermas, who is the servant of Norrell. He started out as a villain?
Yeah, I sort of had the idea. I knew that Norrell was going to do some things which were not entirely honourable, and it seemed to me that part of that would be that he would have this very manipulative servant, but who was called Childemas. But Childemas was the one character in the novel who just refused to do what I intended for him, and he consistently sort of made his own way through the book, rather as in the story he makes his own way through the world. So he was a very interesting character for me, because it was almost like I was reading a story, because this was the guy I didn't really know about.
When you were charting out then and just writing, I mean, Strange must have surprised you at times as well.
I knew, as I say at the beginning, I knew more his emotional journey. I didn't know everything he would do. And I think at times he surprised me by his selfishness. He got a bit more self-centered than I expected him to be. But no, he was a character who was fixed in my mind quite early on.
There's also another character, a black former slave, well, actually he's brought over as a baby, who's raised in England and becomes a servant. He gets involved with the fairies. What's his genesis? Was he there from the beginning?
He was there from, Stephen Black was there from very early on. It was a thing I stumbled on without really understanding it. I, as well as the writing group that I attended with Jeff Ryman and Colin Greenland, and there was another writing group in Cambridge that I went to every week for several years. And the tutor in charge of that group, a woman called Tinch Minter, had written a play about a black violin player of the 18th century who was well known in England at that time. And her just talking about this sort of made me come up with Stephen Black. And what I realized was, and this was entirely fortuitous, was that by having someone who was already outside English society, like a black servant who could look on English society from the outside, it somehow made the fairy more real, because there was someone who could kind of mediate a bit between this totally fantastic outsider and the characters who were in sort of conventional Regency society.
You're listening to an interview with Susanna Clarke, whose book is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Let's talk about the fairy character, the gentleman with the thistledown hair. What is thistledown?
Thistledown is, well, in England and Scotland, there are thistles, and when the flower goes, you get these little seeds with kind of little white silvery filaments attached to them, and then they blow away into the air. But they're sort of, so you get these flowers with these silvery shiny heads.
And
very
so
pretty.
That he's kind of got a silvery shiny head.
Yeah.
Did you intend for him to be the villain of the piece from the start?
Oh, yeah.
There's another one who's a villain, too.
Yeah. But also, I think in a way, the gentleman with the thistledown hair is not exactly a villain. My idea of the fairies is that they are kind of outside human morality. So a lot of what they do seems unutterably wicked, but that's kind of because good and evil are a little bit mystifying to them. They're incredibly self-centered and egotistical. So they just do the first thing that comes into their heads. And sometimes it's good for the people who come into contact them, and sometimes it's really bad news.
There's another character, Lascelles, who takes on a greater and greater role as the book goes on. And he is the human villain of the piece, which you kind of know from the very beginning. He's not a nice guy. I guess the intention there was to keep him, to make him that. My question is, when you've got a character like that, how do you try to humanize him? Or do you bother at all? Do you care?
There is a sort of arc to his character in the book. It's just not a very, very big arc. I mean, he certainly, by the end of the piece, I admit, he is pretty villainous. But at the beginning, he is just incredibly selfish, which is, I think, a thing you can recognize in a lot of people. So I hope that he seems reasonably human.
You have several other characters. Did you do any research on Wellington?
I did a huge amount, but it's still only a tiny proportion of what's out there. He was a character that, from very early on, I just found absolutely fascinating, because he's the sort of person that there just isn't anyone like him around now. He was in his time as famous and as admired as a football star or a pop star, but he was a soldier and saved Europe twice, which, you know, is pretty impressive.
Did you try your damnedest to find his personality so you could stick that personality inside this?
Wellington's personality is pretty easy to find, it has to be said. He was very good at one-liners. Publish and be damned was originally Wellington. So his personality kind of leaps up off the page at you.
There's another element to the book, the footnotes. What prompted you? They're a major section of the book. What prompted you to put in the footnotes?
They kind of happened by accident. Originally, one of my ideas for the book was that I was going to write it as an 18th century novel of letters, with the characters all writing to each other. But I tried this and soon abandoned it because it seemed quite long-winded. But there was a freedom in those letters that I missed. And I also needed to paint a picture of the medieval world that underpins these 19th century events. And I think I tried a footnote and suddenly realized that I had the perfect vehicle to do this. And now there are 150 or 180 of them.
And some of them are, you know, multiple page. These footnotes go into great depth about the Raven King, which comes back to an earlier question, maintaining consistency in history. Do you have anywhere a guide to what happened when or who these characters are?
I have a long document which tells me about all the different magicians in English history.
Just that.
Without that, I would have got pretty lost, because they all had to have their dates and their publications in the footnotes. The Raven King, though, is in some ways, I think, the character nearest to my heart, although he doesn't play a huge role in the book in the sense that he isn't talked about that much. But when he is talked about, I think the reader knows that it is really significant, and he underpins. He's sort of behind a lot of what's going on in the book.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I recall in the first half of the book, he's never given a name. And in the second half, you suddenly start referring to him as John Usglass. Am I wrong on that?
No. The book is in three parts, and what I intended was that in the first part he would always be called the Raven King. Then the second part, it would sort of be mixed between Raven King and John Usglass. And in the third part, he would always be called John Usglass. And the reasoning behind that is a little complicated. It's part of his mystery. I think the Raven King represents the way he is very, very distant. It's one of his titles. It's a title he probably never used himself, but a title other people referred to him by. And it makes him seem very far away. The name John Usglass makes him seem more ordinary. So as the book progresses, you're just getting a bit closer to him, but not that close.
Well, his reign as one of the kings of England happened 500 years before the book begins. So.
Yes, but his influence, his reign is actually in the north of England. In my version, England has been at one time two kingdoms. And so he ruled over northern England. And I know because I've lived in northern England, that northerners still feel that they're different from southerners. And to be honest, southerners feel this too. So in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the people of North England, they still feel a loyalty to him. So he's still around in some ways.
Well, it becomes clear as the book progresses that he is literally still around. There's also the relationship of religion which I know plays a greater role as it goes on. What is the relationship between Christianity and the world of magicians and fairy? And it seems as the book progresses, this conflict between Christianity and fairy comes more to the fore. At least it seemed that way to me. Is that the way it seemed that way to you?
This is a kind of interesting question. To me, it always seemed reasonably straightforward. I wanted the magic to seem like it could fit into a lot of English history as we know it. And if you have a medieval king like the Raven King, John Asclas, and he is going to rule over a kingdom for 300 years, then it seemed to me he would have to be, in many senses, a Christian king. Otherwise, no matter how powerful he was, the other European kings would not be able to tolerate him. They would have to do something about him. So therefore, there must have been some accommodation made between magic and Christianity. And I think the footnotes kind of explain that. But that's not to say that medieval magicians wouldn't be in constant peril, slipping into one form of heresy or another and attracting the more unpleasant sides of the medieval Christian church. I think as the book goes on, there is more explanation of this. But, for example, in the time, the early 19th century, I would imagine that Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell were both conventional Christians of that time and would go to church because that's what everybody did.
Toward the end of the book, I recall a passage where when Norrell and Strange have kind of fallen off their pedestals, the church people are rather glad about this. I'm trying to remember the point. I think it's in a conversation between Norrell and it might be one of the political people that the failure of British magic is not...
This isn't ringing any bells.
It's there. I mean, it is. Yeah. I read the book this week.
No, you did. You did. I can't
remember an exact place, but it is there where there's a conflict that kind of never appeared before. But it's like the Christians seem to know that there's that.
I think how it seems to me is that the Christian community in 1817, say, would have been pretty much everybody in England, 99.5% of everybody. And therefore, there would be all shades of opinion about magic contained within the Christian community. And some people would have been pleased at the difficulty Strange and Norrell would have got themselves into, and some people would have been patriotically worried about it because that, in my version, they were a kind of mainstay of English stability.
About three quarters of the way through the book, the plot becomes very, very clear. As you were writing it, is that when the plot suddenly said, aha? Or was the aha early on?
The aha was definitely earlier on, but there was a series of ahas every time I figured out some way of actually getting to where I wanted to go, right up to the very end. There was still, well, I know where I want to be, but there are still all these, there is still, I have no idea where is the map to get me there.
Did you do any research in Venice?
I had actually been to Venice two or three times before I wrote the end of the book, and we did do one trip back to make sure that what I remembered was accurate, but what I remembered was pretty accurate.
I don't recall by the early 1800s that there were any Jews left in Judaica. You seem to indicate there were.
There were certainly some in the ghetto. If I'm wrong about that, it's possible. I don't have the facts in my head like I once did. A lot of stuff has been pushed out since I finished this book.
You finished the book, and you had this giant manuscript. You did have the connections. You were able to get an agent. And how close, when you finished the first draft, were you to the final version as it emerged?
I don't really write in that way. I don't do drafts. What I tend to do is to write each chapter I start from bits of sentences and scraps of dialogue and scraps of description, and I build up till I have complete sentences and complete paragraphs and eventually a complete chapter. And once that is done, that chapter is done. And I don't tend to revise it at all. So I had got, I think, the two first volumes of the book finished, and quite a lot of the third and final volume at the point at which it was sold.
Did you know there would be illustrations in there?
No, this is not something you could know, because it's something that British publishers rarely do for fiction. I'm not entirely sure why, but I had met Portia Rosenberg, the illustrator, before, well, years before, while I was writing it, and I had an idea that she would be a perfect illustrator. So this was just a sort of dream I had, never thinking for a moment that it was really a possibility. But she did about five illustrations to accompany the first two parts, which my agent sent out to publishers. And much to my surprise, when it was sold to Bloomsbury and I expressed an interest in having it illustrated, they said yes.
At the time the book came out, you gave several interviews in which you talked about a sequel in which there would be a lot more about the Raven King, but it would have characters from this book might flow into that, but it would be a different story, maybe more lower class people. Where are you on that a year later?
I am somewhat further on, but I don't know that I can say very much. I think you've given a very succinct description of it, actually. You clearly know more about it than I do. You should tell me more.
Well, these were your quotes, not mine.
Yeah. Well, you've summed it up very well. Yeah, and I'm still working on it.
Would that book be another large book like this one? Or?
I would have thought not as large, but I am not known for my conciseness. And I am also not known for being a judge of these things in advance. I was expecting this book to be about 100,000 words shorter than it turned out. So,
you also are now a full-time writer. That means it won't take 10 more years.
That's the theory, yeah.
how's the writing going then, now that you're able to focus on it?
It's going pretty well. I have been somewhat dogged by ill health the last year, so it's not going as fast as I would like, but I think surely every writer you get in here probably says the same thing.
Some do, some don't. Some just can just come
just
up with a book a year. I don't know how they do
along.
It.
Yes, well, I envy them.
Have you had any word on film or television options on the book?
The film is being optioned by New Line, who did Lord of the Rings. And we haven't quite signed on the dotted line as yet. The contract, when I last saw it, was 50 pages long and growing. And but the good news is that Christopher Hampton, who did Les Liaisons Dangereuses and the screenplay for Dangerous Liaisons, has either just finished a screenplay or else is in the process of finishing one.
In your head, can you see the characters? Or is this so? Let me put it this way. When people give away their books to film, they generally just take the money and run because there's nothing they can do. Do you feel that you should get some kind of input here?
I will be consulted on various things, which is great. But obviously, the film company are the people who are putting up all the money. And if it happens, they will expect to have the deciding vote, shall we say, which I kind of understand.
You won the Hugo Award for Best Science Fiction Novel. When you found out you had won or even been nominated, did that surprise you, because it's not a science fiction novel?
Yes, it did. And traditionally, the Hugo is won by, you know, science fiction. So it was a huge honor. I mean, the great thing about the Hugo is that it is voted for by the fans. It isn't a panel of experts or writers, but people vote for what they have enjoyed that year.
Did you ask anybody about how it came to be nominated?
As I understand it, the rules allow for fantasy novels to be nominated, and as I understand it, it's not the first fantasy novel to have won. I think, did J.K. Rowling win one year? I think maybe she did.
Susanna Clarke, you're very heavily involved in the fantasy world. You read a lot of books in fantasy. A lot of people in America, because of the way genre fiction has been compartmentalized, particularly over the past decade, don't know who to look for to read. Can you offer a couple of names?
Well, I don't read that much contemporary fiction at all. I tend to go back to the 19th century. And the fantasy books that I do read have tended to be the fantasy classics. What I read in fantasy tends a lot of the time to be either children's books or graphic novels, comics. Having said that, I would recommend Alan Garner's latest, Thursbitch. It is the antithesis of Jonathan Strange, Mr. Norton. It's a very short book, but it's a very intense read. And it's also about Northern England. So the landscapes which are discussed in Strange and Norrell are sort of even more vividly presented there.
Both Christopher Hampton and Julian Fellowes took stabs at writing the film adaptation of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, but both were unable to translate the very long novel into a screenplay, and then New Line canceled the project. It was eventually developed into a 7-part miniseries for the BBC and aired in both the United States and Britain in 2015. It is now streaming on Amazon Prime. After the publication of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell and the awards, Susanna Clarke continued to work on the sequel, which was set in the same universe a few years later, but she became bogged down, sentence by sentence almost, as chronic fatigue syndrome took its toll. By 2015, after visiting the set of the BBC production, she decided to go another route and went back to another manuscript that likely predated this one. That novel, Piranesi, was published to mostly favorable reviews in 2020. She is now working on a third novel. You've been listening to an interview with Susanna Clarke discussing her now classic fantasy novel, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. It was recorded in the KPFA studios on September 12, 2005. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio shows on Facebook.